Previously on Willing to Adapt.
Today we are talking about Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. We're going to talk a little bit about the 1950 movie. Well, it's funny because nowadays when we think of pirates, we're actually heavily we pull a lot of what we think of as pirates from this book. Mm-hmm. Treasure Island, it's an adventure and historical novel. It was published in 1883, and it tells the story of buccaneers and buried gold. It's set in the 1700s, and it's considered a coming-of-age story, and it's noted for its atmosphere, characters, and action. I don't trust this crew, but I don't trust... It's not that I trust them enough to not go on the voyage, he says. It's just enough that I'm really concerned. And I need you to know that.
I forgot about that part.
The 1950 Treasure Island Disney live-action adaptation. Yep. This film is responsible as popularizing the portrayal of what a pirate is, specifically in how they talk.
Oh, okay.
And then basically it's like, oh, well, look, we found the treasure map. And it's like, okay, you're coming with us, Jim. They do kind of play into the Disney film a lot more of this, that Long John's kind of a good guy.
They do. I agree with you on that.
Did you like the film adaptation?
I did. I did enjoy it. It was very Disney.
I'm Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
Hi, welcome back to Willing to Adapt. I am Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
This is the third part of our Treasure Island / Treasure Planet
episode. Yes, it is.
We hope you all listened to the first two. Mm-hmm. If you haven't, please go back and listen to them. Otherwise, this might be confusing. I don't know. Maybe you're really smart. I don't know. But we talked about Robert Louis Stevenson and Treasure Island, the novel, in the first episode. And then we talked about the 1950 Disney live-action adaptation in the second episode.
Yep.
Anything else you want to say before we jump into Treasure Planet?
Nothing I can think of.
All right. When was the first time you watched Treasure Planet?
I'll let you guess that.
It was not for this.
It was for this.
No, it was not.
It was. This is the part of Disney that I have no connection to, the era.
Because you were in your early 20s?
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
When did this come out?
2002.
Oh, definitely. I was in my early 20s. Yeah,
I was 9.
Wow.
I know. I was almost 10. I was almost 10.
Okay. I was probably mid-20s then. How old am I? How old are you?
How old am I now? I'm almost 32.
No, I'm more than 42. I forgot my age. Yeah, never mind. I forgot how old I am. In my mind right now, I'm 42, but I'm not.
Yeah, what year were you born?
78.
Now I can do the math.
Yes. So like, this movie... Atlantis I saw, I don't know when that came out, Dinosaur, Home on the Range, or whatever it was called.
Home on the Range was not very good.
Yeah, I never saw any
like,
of those.
I kind of enjoyed it because I was young, but it's not a good movie.
Hercules
is great.
I didn't see that until like 2 years ago.
Hunchback
I've never seen.
That's sad.
It's just, at that point...
We're going to do Hunchback at some point.
At this point, you're in your early 20s, mid-20s, and going to a movie by yourself to go see a kid's movie just doesn't look that good.
But you see, you also were with a different crowd.
Yes.
Because the crowd that I was with didn't care.
Mm.
Also, I think nowadays, it's not as weird for old people to go to see things geared towards
younger
people.
Well, no. I'm not saying being older and seeing it, because I would go, some of my friends and I have gone to go see, you know, different like Toy Story.
Well, now you
like
don't
that.
Care.
No, true. But even back then, I don't think I would have cared. It was just I didn't have anyone to go, so I would have been going to the movies by myself.
Why is that a problem?
An older guy going to see a kid's movie by yourself just kind of has a bad connotation to it.
I think it's more of a teen movie, really.
Okay. Yeah, I guess. I mean, it was a Disney movie, so that's how I saw it more as a kid's movie.
We'll talk about that. I think Treasure Planet seemed kind of like a movie that Disney didn't really know what to do with. And when I start talking to you, and if unless maybe you've done research too, it seems like a movie that Disney actually really didn't want to make.
Correct.
And
Well, it depends if you believe the conspiracy theories.
Well, no. Like, logistically, for at least 15 years, Disney did not want to make this film.
Oh, yes, yes. No, like, that is true.
The directors had really fight to make this film.
Yes, they were always put on other projects.
But it's also a movie that Disney didn't really know what to do with because it did not fit into Disney movies of that time period. Disney movies of that time period had a love interest, and they were musicals. And, and like, they weren't really action-based. Like, there was some action in them, but they weren't, like, action-adventure films by themselves.
Yeah.
And so they weren't used to films directed more towards boys, men, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Which is clearly what this one is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, I'll jump right in here. Treasure Planet is a 2002 American animated science fiction action adventure film produced by Walt Disney Feature Animation and released by Walt Disney Pictures. It, of course, is adapted by Robert Louis Stevenson's adventure novel Treasure Island. It was directed by John Musker and Ron Clements. And for anybody who does not know those names, they were huge in the Disney Renaissance.
Yeah, they were.
They first really started with The Great Mouse Detective,
mm-hmm.
which, if you haven't seen, is pretty good. But it helped launch Disney's Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
Then they directed The Little Mermaid.
Don't they also do
Beauty and the Beast?
Black Cauldron?
And Aladdin. I think they directed it, but they definitely worked on it.
I'm pretty sure they were tied to that one, too.
And they did Hercules. They did a bunch of the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it starred Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Brian Murray, Emma Thompson, who I love, David Hyde Pierce, Martin Short, and many others. The one I like to do a shout out to is Laurie Metcalf. Laurie Metcalf was on Roseanne.
Oh, yes.
She was, I think, the neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And she also is the voice of Andy's mom in Toy Story.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yes. I've always loved her voice.
My wife recognized the voice but couldn't figure out who it was, mm-hmm. and I had to look it up because mm-hmm. I sounded familiar.
Did you ever watch Uncle Buck?
Yes.
She's the weird neighbor that like hits on him.
Oh, really?
She dances with him. She freaks out with the whole laundry room scene.
It's been a long time since
I've seen that movie. Oh, that movie's so funny.
I've seen the ending.
Did you know that
like
movie
times,
but... is the reason why Home Alone exists?
No, I did not.
Yeah, we'll talk about... That's not really something for our podcast because Home Alone's not an adaptation. So very briefly, I'll say... when they were filming Uncle Buck, John Hughes really liked Macaulay Culkin, and he liked the interaction with him and Uncle and John Candy and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, how can I come up with a story that Macaulay Culkin can be in? And then he slowly came up with the idea of Home Alone.
That's funny.
The movie Treasure Planet has music by James Newton Howard, and it was released on November 6, 2002 in Paris. And November 27th, 2002 in America. It had a budget of $140 million, which was, I think, the highest at the time that Disney had mm-hmm. compared to a lot of the other movies they had come up with. But unfortunately, it only made $109.6 million at the box office. It was a flop.
Yeah.
Fun fact, it was nominated for an Academy Award.
Mm.
So I think that's really fun. It's interesting. The film was directed, I said, by John Musker and Ron Clements. And it was from a screenplay by them and someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically like a passion project, I think you also kind of saw. It was their first non-musical film, as I kind of said, since The Great Mouse Detective. And they pitched the concept for the film during production of The Black Cauldron. And Disney's like, yeah, no, please go do The Great Mouse Detective. And then they did The Great Mouse Detective, and then... they said, hey, can we make this film now? And then they said, no, go do Little Mermaid.
Mm.
And it just kept happening until... But they kept working on it, right? Like they kept coming up with ideas. They kept trying to solidify it and stuff. They basically just kept calling it Treasure Island in Space.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until Disney approached them and said, hey, we want you to direct Hercules. They kind of put their foot down and said, we will only direct Hercules if you let us do Treasure Planet. And then Disney said, okay, fine.
I heard a slightly different version of that.
Did you hear?
That they had to... The story I heard was something along the lines that Disney said they had to do three different movies and the three different movies had to do well. Or at least the one, something like that. Or the third movie they did had to do well.
Yeah,
if they did well, then they could do it or something like that.
Yeah. I watched the video that you watched. I couldn't find it this time, but I watched some other ones. That was a very well-researched video, so I trust it. It mm-hmm. did get a little conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, he did.
I still think there's truth to what he says, but I think it gets a little too conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
I think it depends on who you talk to.
I think it's an oversimplification of the mechanics of movies and making movies and things like that.
Yeah. No, making movies is not as easy as people think it is. And it's also very political,
yes.
very bureaucratic. And the whole studio system, when people complain about the studio system, mm-hmm. they don't understand the studio system is annoying.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot of people, like, it boils down to people making decisions who don't really understand how to make those decisions sometimes.
Like most businesses, yep.
Anyway, I think it depends on who you talk to. Mm-hmm. I think it was one of those things where, because they were going through different CEOs and different leaders of the different departments and stuff. So I think when the Clements and Musker were talking to different people, they mm-hmm. were hearing different things.
Okay.
And so I think originally it was, hey, you just need to prove you can do this mm-hmm. because this movie is a kind of a risk for us. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, can you prove you can be financially successful mm-hmm. before we greenlight this? But then because they weren't getting greenlit, it sounds like when they were approached to do Hercules, they said, we're not going to do it unless mm-hmm. you greenlight Treasure Planet. And mm-hmm. then it was like, well, you guys kind of are like what we need. So, okay, fine. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The one thing we'll talk about the conspiracy theory a little bit now so we don't have to go too much into it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about it?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
I watched a couple different things and I read some stuff, but
sure.
Yeah, I'll just add anything I think you might miss.
We're going to boil down a lot. Mm-hmm. So one of the things about Treasure Planet, how about this? Did you like the film?
It's complicated.
Would you watch the film again?
Yes, I would now.
Okay.
But
okay, go ahead.
I it's not anything on my list to watch anytime soon. But the reasons I would rewatch it are probably not for the same reasons most people would.
You're also not the age and you're not the age that it was directed at.
That's why. Yeah. In fact, I'll talk about that more a little. Yeah. I'm not sure if we're gonna when, but
sure.
Yeah.
I already said 9 when mm-hmm. the film came out, almost 10. So I don't remember seeing it in theaters, but I must have. I really remember watching it on reruns, like on Disney okay. Channel with the commercials and yeah. stuff. And then I had the PlayStation 2 video game.
Which they did reference in a video I watched.
I loved that game.
I heard it added a lot to the post, like the epilogue, essentially.
A little bit. I mean, it fills in the gaps a lot because it's a video game. You need to do a lot more.
Yeah.
But it was fun because the video game had scenes from the film.
Okay.
So you would play it and then you would watch a cut scene. And
mm-hmm.
It was fun. I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
You got to flesh out the world a bit. And I don't know. I liked it. And also, like, that was when the PS2 like first came out.
Mm.
So it was like any game you can get, you know?
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to try and go over this very quickly. The gist of what people believe about Treasure Planet by people who love Treasure Planet,
mm-hmm.
it boils down to how did this film fail?
Yeah.
And that is the question. And I'm sure it's the question Disney asked.
Mm-hmm.
It's the question a lot of people ask. Disney, whenever you talk to anybody about Treasure Planet, it's either, what is that, or, my gosh, that is such an underrated movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's one or the other. I've never met someone who hates it.
Mm.
It's always, it's such a good movie. Why is it not better known?
Mm-hmm.
And why did it not do well? Or, what is it?
Yeah.
But some of the conspiracy theory that surrounds the film is mainly Disney wanted the film to tank.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a kernel of truth to it, but not in the way that we necessarily think and not the way that conspiracy theorists talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, also, we're not in the minds of the people who made these decisions, so yeah. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it kind of comes down to is the film, and we'll talk about this, was so expensive to make.
Yeah.
Literally the most expensive out of, like, I think all the Disney films they had made, like, in the last decade.
Yeah.
And part of that was because they were doing things technologically and artistically that really pushed the envelope
mm-hmm.
and really made it look really good. Like, there really are maybe only a very small amount of scenes that look a little cheesy because it's so well done.
Yeah.
Especially for early CGI. Mm-hmm. And there is this concept that Disney was using. Technically, Disney animated three different films for this. Because they did 2D style animation with the characters and a couple of backgrounds and stuff. But then they used some small CGI for certain things, especially like in this version, Long John Silver is a cyborg, which is an interesting adaptation. For his eye and his arm and stuff, though, that's all with CGI.
Correct. Yeah.
But they did it in a way that looked like 2D style. So it molded very well with the 2D style.
It did.
And it really looks flawless. Like, it's so good. And then there's something that Disney had come up with when they did Tarzan called Deep Canvas.
Yeah.
And it's similar to CGI in that it creates surroundings and environments, but in a way that looks like a 2D style animation, but allows you to move around in the world in a way that you couldn't if you were hand drawing it.
Yes.
And Disney first, like I said, Disney first did it with Tarzan, and it's, there's scenes where you watch the making of it and you're like, oh, that wasn't drawn? That's that's really good.
I don't even think I've seen Tarzan all the way through.
Tarzan's so good. That's another one we can do
I've
for an adaptation.
I've seen most of it, but yeah. But I'd watched the videos. They were showing the deep canvas.
Right.
Yeah. It was interesting.
But there are so many things that they did in Treasure Planet that they have never done before and they have never done since. But anyway, the conspiracy theory goes that Disney was spending so much on this that the higher executives were getting very nervous, because if the movie did well, they would have to continue spending that much money and doing all of that style of animation. And they weren't, the conspiracy theory goes that they didn't want to do that, and so they purposefully tanked the movie from doing well. And some of the evidence that people give for that, which I think there is some merit to this, is they purposefully planned for the film to come out at the same time as Lord of the Rings, Two Towers, and Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Which everyone wanted to see both of those films because the previous films had come out the year before. And Disney should have known that, like, Disney's marketing team knows what they're doing. Disney's marketing team knows how to market a film. And they did not market this film. Like, there is some evidence that they did more marketing after the movie didn't do well at first. But again, when your corporation is so big that you're different, you know, there's arguments to be made on both sides of this. But they also, the trailers are horrible for Treasure Planet. They were so cheesy and dumb and did not evoke any of the emotions of the film. And so people just didn't really know what they were getting when they saw the trailer. Anyway, there's probably more to it, but I don't want to go too much down that rabbit hole.
That's funny because I actually read a different...
Tell me.
So, and I'm going to read what someone wrote here. This is from, it's a comment someone wrote on one of the video we watched.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
And the person says, I'll keep this brief because I don't want to get anyone in trouble, but I know for certain, you know, we have to take that with a grain of salt.
Sure.
That your theory is correct. And he says, when he was studying animation in college, he had a professor who had worked on Treasure Planet, and they assured me that the awful marketing for this movie was intentional. Disney wanted a reason to move away from 2D animation, and Treasure Planet was a carefully calculated scapegoat. They poured a ton of effort and talent into this movie and rigged it to flop. It was the perfect reason for them to say, this style of animation clearly isn't lucrative, we're putting it to bed. And I know in the video he goes on to say that shortly after this, or maybe it was another video, they removed, like, their 2D animation studio only lasted another 2 years before they finally wrapped it up. And now the only 2D animators they have are the ones who do the projections on the fireworks at Disneyland.
Yeah, well, and you know, more evidence to this is, you know, with the success of Pixar.
That was one of the things they brought up, yeah.
Like, Disney, you're able to do CGI, movies entirely with CGI for much cheaper. And from a business standpoint, it makes sense. And, you know, Monsters, Inc. did ridiculously well. And you know, Finding Nemo went on to do really well, and
because I don't think they've used that deep. What did you call it? Deep canvas. After this one, they didn't use it ever again.
Only for
this and Tarzan.
Yes, They might have used it a little bit in Atlantis.
Okay.
I think they might have used it a little bit in Atlantis. Mm. But Atlantis use a lot more of the 2D style and just CGI.
Okay.
And so when you watch Atlantis, which I also really love Atlantis, but I really like both Atlantis and Treasure Planet because it really felt like they were geared to me.
Mm.
Like, I love the traditional Disney films, which I will say the traditional Disney films with Walt Disney are very different than the Disney Renaissance. They're yeah. definitely related, yeah. but they're different.
They are.
Mm-hmm. And so the Disney Renaissance is kind of in a league of its own. It's very formulaic in some mm-hmm. ways, and it definitely leans into the princess aspect and the mm-hmm. romance aspect, where that necessarily was not always there with Walt Disney's. Anyway, I like those films. I have nothing wrong with them. They're great. Yeah. But, you know, as a boy, mm-hmm. and now a man, there is something about a film that is clearly directed towards me in a masculine way
mm-hmm.
that is really fun.
Mm.
Something relatable, and the fact that, like, he has no love interest in the film.
Yeah.
Like, I think people were so used to there being a love interest that they didn't really know how to respond to there not being a love interest
mm-hmm.
in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, like, some of the criticism is, like, why didn't he have someone that he could fall in love with? And I think people were used to there being songs and everything, and there was no songs. And, mm. Yeah. It definitely broke the mold.
Yeah.
And I think people weren't really ready for it. But also...
Yeah, it's no, like, I...
You could have made this a summer movie.
They could have, but I think I kind of wonder if it was one of those things where, and granted, I don't know much about the studio world and how they work, and mm-hmm. perhaps they were trying to get rid of 2D
studios
animators.
Will literally, I firmly believe, I think there is truth to that.
No, I think there's truth. There's yeah. always a kernel of truth.
But like I said, because it's a corporation, I think it was like there were certain people pushing for that,
but
not everybody was on board.
Yeah,
and everybody knew.
And part of me wonders,
like, it wasn't like, this like overlord thing,
yeah.
you know?
And that's what I'm wondering, is if it was more along the lines yeah. of, they put the money in it. They thought, all right, hey, you guys did well. We'll let you try it.
It's part of your contract that you can make this film. You can make this film.
Yeah. And then so they did it, and then they saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were like, "We don't. What are we going to do with this? They're done. We're not going to shelve it."
I think every business, lackluster no matter marketing. What you hide behind, mm-hmm. no matter how family-friendly you are, no matter what your values you proclaim to have, mm-hmm. there will always be people who are in it for the money.
Yeah. And they probably didn't see money.
Disney
in
is
it.
No exception to that, especially now.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I think that may have been part of why they had poor marketing, is if they looked at it, didn't understand it, and said, "Well, we're going to release it anyway. We spent too much money here. Let's just do second rate marketing and see mm-hmm. what happens."
Yeah, I think if I'm trying to flesh this out in a more realistic way, mm-hmm. I think what it was is there was probably some higher execs who could make this decision,
mm-hmm.
but make it behind closed doors.
Mm.
And so I think there were people who were still trying to make them, to save the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And there, I think it was, the damage was done.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I think it's one of those movies everybody should watch. I think everybody should watch it at least once. If it's not your cup of tea, that's fine. It's not your cup of tea,
mm-hmm.
but it's a gorgeous movie.
Yeah.
And even the music's great, and we're going to talk about the movie for sure. But I connected to Jim's character at a visceral level growing up.
So that's why I listened. So in the first episode, if those who have listened to it, I mentioned watching a video on by a therapist watches Treasure Island
mm-hmm.
and or Treasure Planet. And so that was the reason, because when I was reading the comments on the video we watched, I usually hate reading comments. I know people love the comment section.
It really depends on the video.
Yeah. In general, I don't read comments. Normally, I just don't care what other people think. Unless I, that's not 100% true. There are some people I do care. But in general, people I don't know, usually a comment section is nothing more than just a lot of wasteful, you know. It's never entertaining to me, and it's not informational. However, there are times when I read the comment sections, I can get a sense of certain things. And in this case, what you just expressed was expressed by so many different people about this movie, that and about how it spoke to them. And mm-hmm. then it goes back to what you were saying before about how I'm watching it What did you say? I'm at the wrong age. It's not written for me.
It was not a film directed to your age.
Correct. And reading those comments.
I think
being
a man, I think it's still something you can connect to in a way. True. But yeah. You won't react to it the same way.
And it even, because I've gotten. So I'm going to say something a little more on the personal, kind of personal. So like a lot of, you know, fathers and sons, I've had my stuff with my dad. And a couple years ago.
I think every father and son have had their moments.
Yeah.
Some are worse than others. But.
And a couple of years ago, I finally, my dad and I kind of, you know, we came to, there was a resolution for me.
Bury the hatchet.
And a lot of that's my, you know, for me is no longer an issue.
Good.
I think if I would have watched this movie maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, it would have spoken to me different.
Sure.
And had I seen it as a teenager, which unfortunately I was too old anyway, but had it come out when I was a teenager, it definitely would have spoken to me a lot more.
There's two aspects to the movie. I swear we'll get more into the behind the scenes before, but we need to talk about this.
Yeah.
There's two aspects of it. And one is the father-son aspect, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, that's definitely a key feature of the film. It's a key feature, but it's not like overplayed.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many ways that you could have done this and have been, like, really on the nose, and this was done, it handled so well. But the other thing about it that I connected to more, and it wasn't so much the father or lack of a father thing. I think growing up, especially as a teenager, like a preteen teenager, I wanted my dad to be there more.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized especially that I had it really good.
Yeah.
And I think what, especially because, like, I really had a good dad. I really had an amazing father and mother and family. But I learned a lot more of that later when I started seeing more of the world and more of, like, other people's problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were specific times I went home and I'm like, oh, thank you. You guys were great. Like,
yeah.
I didn't realize how good I had
it. We don't see that when we're at that age. Because you're right. I look at my dad, too. And, I mean, yeah, I kind of had my things, but... You know, now I look back as an adult, as a parent, and I'm like, oh, I see all the things that my dad did for me, I do for my kid.
Right.
You know, but I think there is, for this movie, and it was funny because the comments and then the therapist one I listened to, there's the men who didn't have that, who had no father. And I found it interesting reading the comments or listening to the YouTube videos where they make comments about how it allowed them to feel normal.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least not normal, but at least feel like...
Well, a lot of guys don't talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, guys don't usually talk about our issues with other guys or people. I think emotionally healthy guys do, but it's also not in our nature to really open up regularly.
Yeah.
Like, women usually do open up a lot more and will have conversations and dive a little deeper. I find that if I'm diving deeper and getting more vulnerable and stuff, it's usually only with, like, really close Christian friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because then, you know, we can really interact and understand each other and pray if we have to.
And the trust that comes with
that. There's a lot of trust there.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding, because you're on the same page with your values and things like that, you know?
Yeah.
The other thing, though, with Treasure Planet, not really the father-son aspect, the one thing I really connected with Treasure Planet is not living up to your potential and not really knowing what to do with your life and feeling like whatever you do is not good enough.
Yeah, that was hit on there a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something as, like, a preteen teenager, you feel that. You're in a weird stage of life, especially, I mean, even going into your early 20s, you can feel it too. And, you know, hopefully not later, but sometimes. There's this feeling of, like, pointlessness.
It's because you haven't hit your 40s yet.
Sure.
No, I'm serious. Because then it's that whole generativity thing of, like, am I contributing anything to life, you know, more than just earning a paycheck?
Well, it's one of those things where, you know, as a teenager, you're going through a lot of changes, obviously, but you're trying to understand, specifically in this circumstance, a guy, right? You're trying to understand, what does it mean to be a man?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I still feel like a boy, but I want to be a man, but I'm scared of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that aspect of, I know I can do things, but I don't know where to start. And, like, it's really confusing time.
Yeah.
And the movie really touches on that. The movie really kind of...
It does.
It really shows what it means in some ways to be a teen boy.
Yeah.
And I really liked that, and I really latched onto that, especially when you hear, I don't know how to say his name, John Resnick, the singer from Goo Goo Dolls, right? Because he has two songs in this. He has the song you hear in the middle when you hear, you see a lot of Jim's flashbacks, and the song at the very end when it goes into the credits.
Okay.
The song he sings in the middle of the movie, I'm Still Here, right? Which is such a good song. There's literally a line where it says, like, I'm a boy, no, I'm a man. And, like, it's all about, like, show me, like, what it means. And it's, like, it's the song's all about, like, not knowing how to live in this world, but wanting someone to help him.
I vaguely remember. Yeah. I kind of listened, but didn't really.
I love that song. It's so good. But, like, that's how I felt growing up, like, as a teenager. It's, like, I don't know how to live in this world. I really want someone to come alongside and help me. But not knowing how to get that help and feeling almost ashamed to need it, you know? Anyway, long story short, I really connected with Jim Hawkins' character in the film for a very long time. It's funny because my mom randomly asked all of my siblings and I one time in the car, I think we were going to Disney, like, which Disney character do we identify with? And they were all saying, like, my sister's like, oh, I feel like Rapunzel. And I was like, I hope in a good way. and then I said, I told my mom, I said, because I had done a lot of, you know, maturing and emotional development and stuff. And I said, if you had asked me in high school or in my early 20s or even mid-20s, I would have said Jim Hawkins. Like, I would have said I identify with Jim Hawkins. But now I don't, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, if anything, I identify with him at the very end of the film. But
yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, it's the movie. I think a lot of guys don't have films that can talk to them as teenagers in a healthy way. And this was one of those films.
I agree. I think, yeah, it's an underserved market.
Yeah. Well, teenage guys don't make money for movies, so.
Yeah.
Well, let's go a little bit more into the making of the film first.
Go ahead.
All right, so. The making of this film was just a monster. It was crazy. So many people worked on it. Hundreds and hundreds of animators. Supposedly, Clements wanted to create a space world that was warm and had more life to it than you would normally think of in a science fiction film, as opposed to the stainless steel blue smoke coming from the bowels of heavily pipe-laden treatment of science fiction. He didn't want, like, traditional spaceships and spacesuits and things like that. In order to make the film fun by creating more exciting action sequences, and because they believed that having the characters wear spacesuits and helmets would take all the romance out of it, the crew created the concept of what they called the Ethereum, an outer space filled with atmosphere. And the characters wear 18th century clothing, much like in the original Treasure Island. There were a lot of changes that were made late in the film, like the narrator originally was supposed to be an adult Jim Hawkins, and there's a lot of things they cut out. There was like a scene where Jim's working on a solar surfer, and he's interacting with a different alien child, and it's supposed to show Jim's like sensitive side, and it was supposed to be like an homage to The Catcher in the Rye, apparently. But because the intention to begin the film with a scene of Jim solar surfing, the sequence had to be cut, apparently.
Oh, okay.
They said it was extremely challenging to take a classic novel and set it in outer space, and they did away with some of the science fiction elements, you know, metal spaceships and things, very early on. They said they did a lot of things to make the film more modern, and the idea behind setting the film in outer space was to make the story as exciting for kids now as the book was for kids then.
Which makes sense.
Right. I think it's a smart move that it's not meant to be in our universe, essentially. It's meant to be a completely fantastical realm.
Oh, okay.
Because even in the planet he's on, it's called Montressor. And, like, all the places you go to, like, don't really exist in our world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I told you about the idea of the Ethereum. It's, like, space with atmosphere.
Yeah, it comes from an old idea. Pre-Einstein.
Yeah. In the ether.
Yeah.
People will still say stuff like that just because we're so used to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think from a story standpoint, I mean, I go back and forth on this because I really don't like the rule of cool, what is what people call it. Basically, it's like if you make a decision just because it's cool, mm-hmm. I don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I really struggle with that because sometimes you can have a great concept come from that if you actually work at it.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's what they did here. Mm. Like, there really is no reason why they had to set this in space, but it's cool.
Yeah.
So, like, it's one of those things where, like, as an adult, I'm kind of from, like, this really didn't need to be made, but it's also really cool, and I'm glad they did, you know?
Yeah.
But they, yeah, so in the beginning of the film, when Tony Jay is narrating, he says that opening bit about when the winds of the Ethereum are calm and peaceful, right? Like, so it automatically mm-hmm. just tells you that it's the Ethereum.
Yeah, yeah.
The movie doesn't expel it out to you.
No.
But it's funny because a lot of critics at the time were really confused by the film.
Hmm.
They're like, how are they in space and can breathe? And why are they on ships? And mm-hmm. I think there were a lot of people who took it way too literally.
Probably.
Like, they did not take it as a fantasy adventure.
Yeah.
There's something you probably came across that I really liked. And I've actually done this
mm-hmm.
when I'm designing things. They purposefully took a ratio. Do you remember
the
this?
70-30?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The 70-30 ratio.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Do you want to explain it or do you want me to?
So it's basically 70% like real, wasn't it? Real life and 30% like, fantastical.
And like the source material, yeah.
Yeah.
So like 70% from the original book and time period.
And then the 30% is like the rocket boosters, the solar winds.
Yeah, all the more modernized science fiction stuff.
That's what
yeah.
it was, the more modernized.
Yes.
Like that's what it was, yeah.
And so they even did that with the music and stuff. So they got a lot of music that would have been accurate to the time period and like kind of that.
I don't like a remember little, the music.
There's times where it feels a little folksy and it feels pretty accurate to the 1700s.
Okay.
But then there's a couple of moments where like a guitar will come in, like when it's like high adventure. And obviously, you know, like the biggest moments are like when you have the two modern songs in it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that someone praised the movie on is how seamlessly that those come together. Because those songs should stand out, but they mm-hmm. don't. Like, they really flow really well because, and I think in part because of that ratio, you know.
Okay. So I would like to rewatch it.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple things to say real quick and then.
No, go ahead.
I think I'll give a synopsis because uh-huh. it's a little different.
Yeah, like
it's,
go ahead.
Yeah. So they said, with regard to adapting the characters from the book to the film, we touched on this a little bit. Ron Clements mentioned that the Jim Hawkins in the book is a very smart, very capable kid, but they wanted to make Jim start out as a little troubled kid. Like, he ends up being very capable, but they wanted him to start out kind of troubled, and he doesn't really know who he is, while retaining the aforementioned characteristics from the original character. Because even when you meet him when he's, like, his age in the film, like, he is very smart, and he is very adventurous and brave, and stuff. He doesn't know what to do with his life. And,
yeah.
And stuff. And, you know, it kind of hinges on the fact that his dad left when he was a kid.
Which is another big change.
Yeah. It's a big change, but it kind of makes sense. Like, I'm fine with it from an adaptation standpoint, because mm-hmm. instead of the father dying, it's the father leaving. So in a sense, like, the father's just leaving in both. It's just one is a lot more emotional, I think. Like, there's a lot more baggage.
There he is. And I think I'm tired of the trope. I'm tired of the thing. And so for me, it was like, all right, whatever.
Yeah, but I also think that, one, I think this came out when it wasn't as much of a trope. But true.
Because I'm watching it at a very different time.
But I also think they handled it well.
Yeah,
because I think a lot of films, when it's like, oh, my dad left, and then it's mm-hmm. like, they constantly talk about it, or they always go back to it, or it's like, woe is me. Whereas in this one, it felt more realistic in that I'm not going to talk about my issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when he gets to like a breaking point that he kind of talks about it, you know?
Yeah. No, I think, but for me, that was one of the biggest flaws for me of the movie.
Really?
Is I've gotten tired of the same old. So it kind of brought a lot of feelings that I had for Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Well, I'm not a fan of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, so.
And so when that particular one, it has to do with the main character, one of the main character, Chris Pratt, he finds his father.
Oh yeah, the second one was weird.
Yeah, and then his father ends up.
Y'all.
And then he ends up betraying him, And then he ends up realizing that the adopted father was his real father all the time. And granted, it was fine, whatever. But I'm very sad as a father, and you know, especially as a single father for quite a while, I'm very hypersensitive to those issues. So I think, like you said, had I watched it as a kid, it might have felt differently, or as a teenager, it would have felt differently. As an adult man with a kid, it you know, I bristle at a lot of the anti-father stuff that goes on. Whereas in the book, the father died. That, to me, it's like, okay, that's fine. Even though they didn't really play off it much. So I get it. I get what they did, why they did, and I get why it speaks to a lot of people. But like you said, coming at it from a different age, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. So I'll try to give a brief synopsis. I'll say this. The main plot is the same.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what happens is at least very similar.
Yeah.
So in Treasure Planet, on the planet of Montressor, young Jim Hawkins is enchanted by stories of space pirate Captain Flint and his ability to strike suddenly and disappear without a trace, something they added for this one. The story goes that he hides his treasure on the fabled Treasure Planet. 12 years pass, and Jim grows into an aloof troublemaker after his father abandons the family, which we learn kind of very quickly, actually. They just build on it pretty well. One day, Billy Bones crashes his spaceship near the inn that Jim and his mother, Sarah, run together. Before Billy Bones dies, he gives Jim a sphere, which ends up being a map, and he warns him to beware the cyborg. Very quickly, a group of pirates attack the inn and destroy it, and Jim flees with his mother and their friend, Dr. Doppler. At his house, they discover that the sphere is a map that will lead them to Treasure Planet, and Jim convinces his mother that he needs to do this in order to, like, prove himself and to, like, help her, essentially. Doppler commissions the ship RLS Legacy. Fun fact, did you know that RLS is a tribute mm-hmm. to Robert Louis Stevenson?
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah. It's commanded by the feline-like Captain Amelia instead of Captain Smollett and the first mate, Mr. Arrow. The ship's crew was brought on by John Silver, who turns out to be a cyborg, and Jim is put under his watch. Jim very quickly gets on bad terms with Mr. Scroop, who is aggressive and almost kills him.
Mm-hmm.
But Long John Silver stops that. And so, very quickly, we learn more about Jim's backstory, about how his father left in a montage. And slowly, Long John Silver kind of warms up to him and feels bad for him and starts to like him and takes him under his wing a bit. And in a big space storm, essentially, with like a supernova that turns into a black hole, they are all trying to escape it, and Jim has to tighten everybody's lifelines, and Mr. Scroop takes the chance to essentially cut Mr. Arrow's lifeline, mm-hmm. causing him to drift off and, you know, presumably die.
Yeah.
Jim feels horrible about this because he's led to believe that it's because he missed Mr. Arrow's lifeline, which is why Mr. Arrow died.
Mm-hmm.
And in a moment where Long John Silver is very angry at Mr. Scroop, Long John comforts Jim, and Jim opens up a bit, and they have a father-son kind of bonding moment, kind of like, it's not your fault kind of mm-hmm. thing, you know, and you're going to do great things and sort of thing. Anyway, so as they approach Treasure Planet, Jim discovers that the crew are pirates led by Silver, and a mutiny erupts. In this version, Long John Silver has, instead of a parrot, he has a little alien creature called mm-hmm. Morph, which instead of mimicking people's voices, he can mimic things he sees and touches.
Mm-hmm.
And so we find out later that Morph turns into the map. And so when Jim grabs it, he accidentally grabs Morph. And they all escape the ship. And in the process, Captain Amelia is hurt. Jim has to go and explore Treasure Planet, and he comes across Ben. In this version, it's B-E-N. Was it Bioelectrical Navigator?
Something like that, yeah.
He's a navigational robot who once belonged to Captain Flint and is now missing his primary memory circuit.
Mm-hmm.
They when they realize they don't have the map, but the pirates think they have the map, when Jim's the one who talks to Long John and stands up to him, he, Ben, and Morph sneak back up onto the ship
mm-hmm.
to get the map and possibly disable the cannons. And so what ends up happening is Mr. Scroop fights Jim on the ship. And when Ben's trying to help, he pulls out the anti-gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they start floating. And I actually really liked this scene because it felt kind of like an homage to the book. And that they do end up, because they're floating, they end up at the top of the mast where they would have ended up in the book anyway. But instead of Jim shooting Mr. Scroop, he loses the gun in the action, and then he ends up kind of tricking Mr. Scroop into flying away with the flag.
I will agree that this, cinematically, that probably was my favorite scene.
Oh, it's so good.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, the way, well, the, all the camera angles and...
Between that, and I did like the scene of Mr. Arrow.
And where it's so sad.
It was, yeah. Those are the two, I would say those are the two scenes that kind of...
Because in this version, Mr. Arrow is like just an upright guy, mm-hmm. like just doing his job and making sure everybody's like staying in line. And
yeah.
And he has a good relationship with Captain Amelia. Mm-hmm. Like they definitely really leaned into the emotions.
They did, yeah.
Yeah. So what ends up happening is when Jim and Ben and Morph return back to Treasure Planet, of course, you know, Long John and the pirates have taken over the place. Mm-hmm. And then Jim convinces them he will... only help them with the map, because in this version only he knows how to unlock the map,
yeah,
which is like a really good plot device. And so he tells him, you can, if you don't take us with you, like you can't have the map basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're following it, and then they find out the only way that Flint was able to get away with what he was doing is because he had a system that would open a door to anywhere,
mm-hmm.
in the galaxy, and then he could disappear without a trace. And they find out that the treasure's hidden inside the planet, because the planet is essentially a big mechanism. When they go into the treasure trove, they find Ben's memory chip, but they also remember that there's a booby trap. So this is when things really take a turn from the book and make it very climactic ending, which the book kind of doesn't, is a little anticlimactic for me, but it's still fun.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, they basically have to escape because the planet is exploding.
Yeah,
because Captain Flint didn't want anybody to have his treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a moment where Jim's trying to hook up a ship so they can escape. And then Long John ends up having to choose between the treasure and saving Jim's life when Jim's about to die.
Mm-hmm.
And he ends up choosing Jim. So they get back onto the ship. Of course, there's a whole bit where like Dr. Doppler and Amelia start falling in love, which is random, but fine.
I know.
And then they get back to the ship and... they're about to escape, but then they lose like half their power.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can't get away on time. And so Jim, who has proven at the beginning of the movie that he, and a couple times, that he's very good on like a solar surfer,
mm-hmm.
and other things, he tells them that he will change the doorway so it'll get them out of there, but they have to turn around and go back towards the exploding planet, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it's dramatic, he almost doesn't make it. But he makes it, and they're able to get through, and he saves the day. And the movie ends with Long John Silver trying to escape on a boat, and Jim looks like he's going to stop him, but then he allows him to go. And Long John throws him a handful of golden jewels that he had taken so that Jim can rebuild the Benbow Inn.
Yeah.
And then he goes home, he's reunited with his mom, he has a better relationship, the Benbow Inn's like bigger than it was, and now he's gonna go and be a part of like, I think, the Solar Academy or something like that. Mm-hmm. And of course it's very Disney ending, like,
yeah,
everybody has a happy ending. And but that's it, that's Treasure Planet. Yeah, it's a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it a lot. All right, did you know that for some of the references for Jim Hawkins, they actually were inspired by James Dean?
Yes, I did read that.
Yeah. Probably it's funny, there's certain scenes, especially when he's like really sad,
mm-hmm.
where I'm like, oh yeah, that looks like James Dean.
Yeah, probably another reason why I didn't care for him too much.
Oh.
I'm not a big James Dean fan.
Again, it's definitely more to teenagers.
Yeah. But even as a teenager, I was never really, like, I never identified with the rebel, you know?
Well, I think it depends on which movie, right? Are you thinking about Rebel Without a Cause?
Thinking about just that trope in general. Sure. Yeah.
Have you seen his movies?
Bits and pieces. I've always gotten bored in watching his movies, so I've never been able to sit through a whole thing.
No, you wouldn't like his movies.
Granted, I sat through them when I was like either a teenager or early 20s, so like Great Gatsby, I'd be willing to sit and watch him again.
And there's a fun little bit in it where it's just really smart design choices to really show his kind of, someone said his bad boy, but I think it's more appropriate to say like his kind of state of depression, but like isolation and insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
For like the first half of the movie, Jim's in a very dark, kind of like a black jacket, and his hands are always in the coat.
Oh yeah. I saw the
yeah. But then once he starts to become much more confident in himself and to trust people and kind of like come into his own, he loses it.
Yeah.
He no longer has the jacket for the rest of the film. And he's in like a light color.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's choices like that I really like from a design point, you know. And we already talked about how they seamlessly put together three different types of animation in a way like you almost couldn't even tell sometimes.
I could. I mean, to me, that was another part that kind of threw me off was the...
Well, like his,
I couldn't tell it was three types, but I could definitely tell it was two types. And I think the
I mean, there's jarring, some scenes where it holds up more than others.
It does. But there were some scenes, too, where it was like... It took me a while to get used to the... Anytime I have to switch animation to something new, something different, it takes me a little while to get used to it.
Well, I think the best use of it is with Long John Silver.
Yeah.
Because his arm and his eye, they just... Or seamless with the 2D style.
Those, yeah, that was more. For me, I'm thinking of the background. The background.
Sure.
Threw me off in the beginning, and then I got used to it as time went on.
Yeah, and it's definitely one of those things where you can tell they were making choices to reach a more modern audience.
Mm-hmm.
Like the whole bit about like Jim, like it's important for the climax that he's able to do what he does in order to save the day.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, from a writing standpoint, if you want your film to be more climactic than the book, because the book doesn't really have a great climax for a modern audience.
For a modern audience, yeah.
Because modern audiences are used to like a big climax. And so if you want to write one, you're going to change a few things. Like, and obviously they went with the planet's going to explode. You need to get out of there and save the day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to make it so that Jim is the one who saves the day, which is kind of important for his character development.
Yeah.
Then you need to have a way that he can do it. Mm-hmm. And so for this one, they made it so that he's on a vehicle, essentially, that will get him to save the day.
Yeah, yeah.
And so from a writing standpoint, you have to foreshadow that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how you see, and it helps with his character development, too. But at the beginning of the movie, he's riding on this little solar surfer, and he's breaking into a place, and he's doing it basically for the thrill of it and the adrenaline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just to, like, feel something, you know, which is very... accurate for, I think, a lot of teenage guys. Not all of them, obviously, but it's pretty accurate. You know, we do something a little reckless just to feel something, you know?
Yeah.
But then by the end, he's doing it for good reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But to reach a more modern audience, they purposely designed it so that it was very reminiscent of skateboarding, but also, like, windsurfing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but it still felt cohesive with the film and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
There's things like that they did that... I like it because it's clearly meant to be cool, but they take it and they elevate it to something more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the one thing that I didn't really like, but I'm fine with for their version, is how they changed it from Long John killing Mr. Arrow to Mr. Scroop killing Mr. Arrow.
Mm.
Yeah, it works so well for their version, but it clearly makes Long John less of a villain.
Yeah, but I think that's what they were going for in this one, too. Yeah.
They definitely show a lot more of Jim's emotion, and like you can see the betrayal on Jim's face when he hears the whole bit about how like Long John was just using him.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, you know. All right, so I have one more thing that I want to say, and then we can talk about whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can finish this up. There is one thing that I've heard from countless people that they think is the weak link in this movie.
Which is?
Can you guess?
Not really.
What's the one thing that you think people would hate the most about this movie?
Ben.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I saw that, too.
You know what's funny, though, is I always loved Ben.
Did you like Jar Jar? Someone actually called him the Jar Jar of this
fair,
movie.
That's not fair, though. They're different. Because Ben actually plays a practical role in the plot.
Mm.
Whereas Jar Jar literally did not need to be in that film.
Yeah.
But, like, Ben is important to the plot and... Like, he actually is helpful at times, if sometimes accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
I think what it boils down to more is, do you think Martin Short is funny or not? Because I think Martin Short is hilarious, but he is over the top.
Yeah, it depends on what, because I most of the stuff I've seen him, he is.
And this one, did you like Ben in this movie?
He was all right. I thought it was a little too
over the top.
Not that it was over the top.
I liked it because I felt like it worked for his character, because like he had been abandoned there for so long. And
I mean, I didn't hate it like some people may perhaps may, but it was whatever.
Yeah, some people were making the argument that it was kind of like a tonal shift for the film, which like I can kind of see. But I also think it really played well into Jim's character growth. And
others, I read or heard someone say that I think they felt they threw it in as a throwaway to kids or something along those lines. Like they needed that humor piece because they didn't want it to be too dark or something like that.
I think
it was to lighten
his
it up.
Humor is definitely a new humor for that film.
Mm-hmm.
In that we don't see humor like that prior.
Yeah.
Like there's some goofy humor with Dr. Doppler
mm-hmm.
and stuff, which Dr. Doppler's clearly an amalgamation of both Dr. Livesey and Squire Trelawney.
Correct, yeah.
Which is fine.
Because
I feel like it makes a more nuanced character instead of two flat characters.
Yeah.
It's funny because I get it, but I think Ben's hilarious. And I actually, anytime I watch it, I actually thoroughly enjoy his scenes.
Oh, okay.
Like, I think they're hilarious.
Yeah, I think for me, they were just whatever. It was another goofy Disney throw background character.
Yeah. But again, it does also come back to I watched this as a kid.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's that. But I think it's also one of those things where I kind of like an underdog sometimes.
Mm.
Like I kind of like to find the diamonds in the rough, which this is not a diamond in the rough because it's just a great movie. But it's one of those movies. I like to find movies that should have done well but didn't. That's actually some of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
But if I'm being honest, I think it kind of comes down to like, this is my movie.
Okay.
You know, because if it's not popular, but I really like it, then it's kind of mine, you know? Mm-hmm. I think there's an aspect of that, but everyone wants to feel special. But I don't know. I think it was a well-written movie. I think they add a lot of motivation to the characters, and it's gorgeous. And what were you going to say, though?
So, in the end, the movie was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, after I finished watching it, I felt similar to when I'm watching Tarzan, where it's like, it's all right. It's the music, the singing. I'm not a big fan of throwing contemporary songs, you know, like some of my buddies are really, really love Tarzan. That was their era. I think they're the same age as you.
I enjoy Tarzan.
Yeah. I did not watch it as a kid. I saw it after theater. I've never watched the whole thing. Kind of bores me a bit. This one, I sat down, I watched it. It was interesting. And it was funny because like when they show the gate, you know, of being able to go to different worlds, even though I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure they did not take it from this. I'm like, oh yeah, Star Trek. There was a Star Trek, a Next Generation episode where they find a civilization that's how they were able to, you know, that's how they were able to peer out of thin air.
I mean, it's not a brand new idea.
Yeah. And so a lot of the stuff for me and then Jim's character was a little, it wasn't annoying, but it didn't do anything for me. Long John Silver was too nice. And so in watching it, it was all right. I walked away, and that's why when I was sitting listening to the videos of people who talked about how amazing it's the top three films they've ever watched of animation, I'm like, I don't see it. I don't get it.
It's definitely probably in like, if it's not my top five, it's in my top 10.
Okay. For me, it's not anywhere near my even top 20.
But however, like I said, I think having that emotional connection to it. And
I will say this. After watching the videos, the YouTube videos on it, it did make me appreciate the film more because of that which I did not get to experience from it, but also because of the visuals. Like, I think I actually would like to sit and listen to the music, not the songs. I could care less about the songs, but and maybe I will. Maybe
songs
even
are
those.
Good, though.
Perhaps. Anything that's slow for me is usually boring.
The two songs in the movie are not slow.
They're slow for me.
Okay.
They're not my type of music. And
you don't like the Goo Goo Dolls? They're literally Goo Goo Doll songs. Like, that's what they sound like.
I don't know what their music sounds like. I know the band. No.
I have to play it for you.
Yeah, I'm sure I've heard their songs, but it's not normally what I'll sit and listen to. And so, but
James Newton Howard's score is pretty
good.
That's
what I would like to go back and definitely listen to.
And listen to the launch. Listen to 12 Years Later, mm-hmm. and then listen to the launch. Okay. Those are probably, I mean, obviously the ending music's great too. But.
And even now, as I've listened to that, people talk about, and you brought up a lot of this, either the costuming, or not the costuming, but the outfits, mm-hmm. and the 70-30. This is stuff that I didn't pay attention mm-hmm. to when I was watching it. I was just sitting down and watching an animated feature right. that was an adaptation.
Well, and like when I was going back to that 70-30 ratio, mm-hmm. I purposefully have used that when I have designed for steampunk.
Oh, okay.
Some people call this steampunk, and I think to a degree it kind of is.
Someone's called it steampunk, but done really well.
Yes. I always tell people this. There's two types of steampunk. Mm-hmm. There is Atlantis. Mm-hmm. And their treasure planet. Mm. Atlantis is the grounded in reality. Treasure planet is the fantastical.
Okay.
And they can both be steampunk. Mm-hmm. I usually almost always prefer the Atlantis steampunk.
Yeah, I think that's what you see the most. Mm-hmm.
But no, I think that's steampunk done well. Like, I think they're both steampunk mm-hmm. done well. But it's like, what is your goal?
Yeah.
And like, if you want it to be based in some sort of reality, even if it's doing something impossible, mm-hmm. then the Atlantis steampunk is better, in my opinion.
Okay.
But that's what I will do whenever I do steampunk. If it's in the back of my head, I'll try to have that kind of a 70-30 mm-hmm. rule where it's 70% has to be from like the 1800s, like specific. I'll pick like a date usually, yeah. like 1890 or mm-hmm. whatever. But then 30% can be futuristic.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I like it because it grounds it, you know? Mm-hmm. But what someone pointed out to me in a video, so not me personally, but mm-hmm. someone said that if you watch Treasure Planet from a design standpoint, mm-hmm. it is so amazing what they do because they literally really don't copy anything from anywhere. Like the whole aesthetic and even like the aliens and the vehicles and everything. Like even if they're based in something, mm-hmm. they're not copying anything. Mm. Like you're seeing something that nobody has really done before and nobody has really done since.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I'm just saying it didn't resonate with me.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. And I think that's like that with most movies. Like if you didn't grow up with it or if it didn't hit you at the right time of life or whatever, like mm-hmm. that's fine, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Is there anything else you need to say before we finish this?
Nope. I think I'm good.
All right. Well, real quick, who is your favorite character in this one?
Mr. Arrow.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
He's the only one I identified with, and
because he's like no nonsense.
And... pretty much.
Okay, you didn't like Captain Amelia.
She was all right.
I love her the way she talks.
Yeah, I guess she was a cool character. She was probably my second favorite.
She has the best vocabulary.
Yeah.
When she says let me make this as monosyllabic as possible. I don't care much for this crew you hired. They're, how did I describe them, Arrow? I said something rather good this morning before coffee. And he says, a ludicrous parcel of driveling galoots, ma'am. And she says, there you go, poetry. my favorite character is Jim.
As usual.
But I will, I you won't like this. My very close second is Ben.
Yeah.
And only because I just thoroughly enjoy every moment he is on screen. And I get it. I get it why people don't like him. Mm. But I don't know, he does it for me. I don't know. He's hilarious. And I think Martin Short is so funny. Martin Short does things with his voice that I don't understand. All right. Go ahead. What are you going to say?
Nope. That's it. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Would you watch the movie again then?
Now, after watching those YouTube videos, I would, just to review the animation and the music.
All right. Random question real quick then for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I've already explained the emotional connection that this film has for me, and, you know, it hit me at the right spot in my mm-hmm. life and really connected on a visceral level with Jim and stuff. Has there been a movie at any time in your life that has done that to you?
Oh, many movies.
Yeah, can you give me an example?
So when I was a kid, anytime?
Yeah. You can have one now, I don't care.
So the movies that I'll usually put on in the background that I've resonated with have been usually more, like as an adult, Gladiator, Braveheart. What's the one with, what's his name? Last Samurai.
It's like you watch those movies, and like you just really feel a connection to them. And
for different reasons, yes, or they draw something out of me. And so like as a kid, it would have been like
interesting
the watching the BBC Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
I don't know if you ever watched those. Yeah, they were cheesy.
They were, but they drew something out of me. They were my
first understanding of those, because I watched those before the Disney films came out.
Okay. Yeah, no, me too. And
Disney would never make those films today.
No.
They're too Christian.
They are. And even in watching, I think for me, one of the things I've never been able to understand from people is when people come out and say, I wasn't able to identify with someone until they were like me. So you know how like, oh, well, I've never been able to identify with Captain America because he's white. So now that they have a black character, I identify it. Or even male to female, because surprisingly enough, I identified with like, say, Belle from Beauty and the Beast.
Sure.
You know, because sure. I just even whether it's the song. So even as a teenager, I couldn't identify with every aspect of her, especially sure. the romance part. But the whole opening song. When I heard it for the first time,
it's
I'm like,
great song.
Oh my gosh, that's my life.
You know? We don't have that one planned for this season, but no. We'll have to do that one next season.
That would be cool. There was a lot of times, and then when I was looking at characters that I aspired to be like, there wasn't a lot back in the 80s that I can think of. And so often I would have to be, what is that phrase, you're pulling straws or something? Is that where there's like, basically where there's not a lot and you're trying to pull
grasping straws.
Yes. Kind of like that. And so like I can say even in watching G.I. Joe, like I had, there was one character in G.I. Joe, Duke, that I was like, I want to be like that, you know, and he was my favorite character in the show.
I never watched that.
Yeah, that was in the 80s. I was a little kid. And so there were others. I
wanted to say like The Wrath of Khan or something.
Oh, that speaks to me? So not necessarily The Wrath of Khan, but Star Trek VI did, but that's a whole different reason. You know, as an 80s kid, I resonated with it.
Sure.
But I'm sure there was other stuff, but I would have to actually sit and think about it and review my childhood. Like, I don't remember going to movies very often and things like that.
There was, off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
The two movies that I had visceral reactions to for a very long time,
mm-hmm.
and still kind of do, were Treasure Planet and Brother Bear.
I've never seen that one either.
It's so good.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I've heard people like it. Yeah.
It's, again, another very underrated one.
Mm-hmm.
And Brother Bear came around the same time.
Mm.
But it's just like who his character is and what he goes through and stuff. And there was like a certain amount of guilt the character had, and I just really felt that character. And yeah, I don't want this to turn into something, but
yeah.
All right, well, I'm glad that you had that.
Yeah, I think it was harder in the 80s because we just didn't have as much, you know, there wasn't a lot. I think things were still in their infancy and they were coming to
VHS rentals were just coming out, and
yeah, I mean, and it was, if we saw it on TV, you know,
you didn't go to the library.
We did, but we didn't rent anything.
No, I know.
Yeah.
Did you want to do the scores now?
Sure.
Our arbitrary scores?
Our arbitrary scores.
All right. Do you want to do all three? Or?
I think for me...
Like, did you want to do one for the book, too? Or did you want to... We have the last few, but...
Yeah. So if I had to put it with five... You know, one being, I never want to see this again. Mm-hmm. 10 being, I'm going to read it every day. Or if I had to take it to a deserted island, I would take it with me.
Mm.
I think that's a better way of putting 10.
Like that.
I would have to say the book for me is, it's probably in the 7 range.
Okay.
Yeah. The movie, I think for me, would probably be in the same range as the book.
Which one? The 1950?
The 1950.
One? You said 7?
7.
Okay.
And the animated feature at this moment would probably be in the 5 category for me.
That's low.
I know, but I
don't think that's right.
If it wasn't for that I want to go back and look at the animation and the music.
That's one of your lower scores.
It is.
You really didn't like it that much?
It's not that I didn't like it. It was just average. It was like, it just did not, do anything for me.
Hmm.
Like I was really...
You just sat there looking at your watch. You're like, oh, come on.
No, I wasn't bored. If I was bored, I would give it like when I start getting bored, it goes into the 4 range.
Jeez.
And then that's when I'm starting to. There were a couple times when I did pull my phone out, but I wasn't looking at other stuff.
Maybe your score will
go up again later. Perhaps. Maybe it'll grow on me. Because granted, I will say there are things that grow over time. There's stuff that when I first watched it, it was whatever. you know, and as time has gone on, and it goes the other way too, things that I loved in the early days that I would have no desire to go back and watch anymore. Yeah.
I think I agree with you on the book and the 1950s one. I think though, I'm not going to give the same score. I think I might give the book a 7, maybe.
Okay.
But I think I want to give the 1951 maybe an 8.
Mm-hmm.
We score so differently from each other. I feel like I always go really high and you always go low. And then for Treasure Planet, I want to give it a 10.
Okay.
When I first started doing this podcast, I was really scared to give 10s. Mm-hmm. And now I'm just like, 10, 10. But to be fair, the last couple ones were like very, like they had a very emotional connections.
And yeah.
So that does play into it. I'm very aware of that. So I'm definitely going to give this one a 10 because this one clearly deserves it in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Cool.
I'm glad that we finally got this one out of the way.
Yes.
Oh, man, that was a trip.
Mm-hmm.
Emotional trip.
And so what type of, now we're going to do?
Yes, thank you. All right, now we're going to move on to the final part of our program. We talk about what type of adaptation is this, or in this circumstance, are these? If you have not listened to our podcast before, thanks for listening. I'm glad that you did. But please go back and listen to the trailer for our podcast, because in the trailer, we do talk about what type of adaptations we have come up with.
Mm-hmm.
And by we, I mean me. So I came up with 4 different types of adaptations that we discuss. One of them is true to source material, mm-hmm. which is pretty self-explanatory. Second is expanded, which is, you know, it's usually for shorter stories that have been expanded into longer ones. Mm-hmm. You add a lot of stuff that's not in it. I really wish we could have come up with a condensed. We really need a condensed one.
Yeah.
But the third one is artistic, which we've gotten much more flexible on about. It's really more geared towards like things, movies and books and things that are more metaphorical and symbolic, and there's like weird choices made to emphasize themes and stuff. And then the last one is message driven, which mm-hmm. is the movie really pushes on a main message that may or may not have been in the original source material.
Yeah.
So for the 1950 version first.
I mean, it's weird. It's true to source material with a little expansion.
Yeah. I think I'm going to do just true to source material because it doesn't really expand too much.
No, it's just like maybe 2 areas.
It streamlines and it just mm-hmm. kind of adds a little bit.
Yeah, so I would agree. True to source material.
And what would you say for Treasure Planet?
Message driven.
Yeah? Can mm-hmm. you explain why?
Whereas the other one was more of the, like you said, what you were saying in the first podcast, it mm-hmm. was just an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And this one definitely had a message to it. And mm-hmm. I think that's why
had a couple messages.
Had a couple of them. And that's why for me, I didn't resonate as well, because mm-hmm. they're not messages that are important to me
anymore. I think, to be fair, it's still very much a fun adventure, and it's really meant to be a fun adventure. It is.
But definitely a message was thrown in that wasn't in the original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I agree with
you. I kind of wish I would have watched this with my kid. As a teenage, I'm going to have to reach out. She's in a play. tomorrow or this week, actually right now she's over done with it now, but tonight, tomorrow, another Disney Frozen, and so I'm gonna have to have her watch it, and then I'll record my conversation with her.
Sure. I mean, she's not a guy, so she might like it as much, but
yeah, no, because I've shown her some stereotypical kind of male oriented movies and she didn't appreciate them as much as I did. But it'll be interesting.
And it's one of those movies. This is one of those movies where it's geared more towards guys, but it's not a quote unquote guy movie, because I think when people think guy movie, they think like cars. And
there was
macho
a lot of
and...
comments from girls who really resonated with the Amelia character, Captain Amelia.
Sure,
you know. So
well, I think there are girls out there who also resonate with Jim because of like the emotional experience he goes through.
Probably, but, yeah. They just don't leave any comments.
Anyway. I think I agree with you. I think it's much more of a message-driven movie. It's definitely like an artistic message-driven movie.
Yes, yes.
For sure. Great.
Cool.
I love it when we're not contentious. I will not lie to you. When I went back and re-listened to our Secret of NIMH episodes, and there were times I could not stand you because you and I saw things so differently, and we were both so stubborn. I thought on that was, our views and opinions.
That was a fun one, though. I actually enjoyed. Things,
and I was like getting angry as I was listening to it. I was like, I need to take a break. I can't do this.
That was actually one of my fun. I think one of my. I liked filming that, recording that episode.
I don't know what it comes off to people who listen to that one, because they're just like, these guys are just like arguing the whole time.
Some people like that. Some people like hearing contention at times. Not always when we always agree.
Yes, we definitely had a lot to talk about. We didn't think that one would be a very long one.
No, we didn't.
It turned into, I think, maybe two or three.
Yes, it did.
All right. Anything else you want to finish this one off on?
Nope. I was going to end with a pirate voice, but I'm too tired.
Oh, gosh.
I was going to say, no, matey. That was horrible.
I was thinking about ending with Silver when he tells Jim, he's like, you're going to rattle the stars, you. But I was like, oh, that's cheesy. Yes, it is. Like, it always sounds better in your head, and yes, then you say it, and you're like, I'm going to edit that out. Like, he says it is great, but then, you know, but he's got, like, James Newton Howard's music behind him, but.
You can edit some music into the ending.
Oh, I will put music in the ending, don't worry.
Just make sure it's not something that we're going to get dinged for.
Oh, I always use the free stuff.
Good.
The good free stuff.
All right.
Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Yes.
We hope that you can reach out to us. You can send us an email. It's going to be in the end of this. It's Eric and Romy with an I.
Yes.
Eric and Romy at willingtoadapt.com. We'd love to hear from you. Please send us your questions, your comments, any recommendations. You can also now leave us comments on Spotify. Mm-hmm. So if you're listening on there, please leave us a comment.
Or any of the other places you're listening to us. And I'm going to give a quick shout out to Mr. Legaspino, who is actually listening right now to our very first podcast.
So gosh.
I thought you meant
he was listening to us as we're recording.
No. He just finished reading, because he a buddy of mine, he came up and he's like, hey, I want to start reading. He really wants to become more cultured.
This is Lego?
Lego.
Nice. Hi, Lego.
And so he read Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, he's the one.
He's the one.
Got it. You mentioned him when we were talking about Nutcracker.
Yeah. And so he finished it last week. He watched the BBC version, and then he watched the Keira Knightley version.
Did he like it?
I haven't talked to him about it yet.
Oh, he's like, oh, I hated it.
And so then another friend, Chris, told them to listen to the podcast.
Nice.
And so on my way drive over here, he's like, I'm about to listen to season 1, episode 1 of Willing to Adapt.
So there's so many things about our early episodes. And I say early, like, we've been doing this forever. It's only our second season. But there's so many things about the first season, especially the really early ones.
Yeah.
Because listeners, we started this actually a few years ago.
Yes.
You would never know it, but the power of editing and... But anyway, I was listening to some of those, and I was like, I could have done a better job editing some of these. I could have cut a lot of this out, or like, I think we could have streamlined some of this. Mm. But you know what? That's how we learn.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, thank you again for listening. I know that you have many options on your listening, but...
Thank you for choosing us.
We hope that you got something out of this.
And we hope you join us next time.
We'll catch you next time.
Yes, on Willing to Adapt.
Jeez. All right, bye.
All right, see ya.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromy@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.